From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On the program today, we'll be talking about hashtag MeToo.
While this was shocking to most men that so many women were coming out with hashtag MeToo, it's not shocking to most women.
May Erlewine talks about songs on her latest album.
They're very personal, but then they're also really hitting on that sentiment of it's okay to feel these difficult things and trying to make a little room for it.
We'll hear about underserved farmers fighting the government.
Black farmers, Latino farmers, indigenous farmers, and women farmers have all filed a lawsuit against the USDA in response to that discrimination.
And we'll have a cocktail recipe for you using Michigan heirloom apples and a Michigan-made hard cider.
Cheers.
Plus, we'll talk to our political commentators about a proposal to use local tax dollars for charter schools. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk about hashtag MeToo. But first, let's turn to our Friday political analysts, Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema. He's senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. The Michigan Senate has approved a plan to give local tax dollars to charter schools. It would require a millage for the intermediate school districts to be distributed to both public schools and privately owned charter schools. Four Republican senators voted against this, as well as all of the Democrats. Vicki, this continues a trend to try to subsidize private charters with tax money. According to a Gongwer report, a Republican who voted in favor said it's only fair that all students benefit. What do you think about this proposal?
First of all, I don't like the whole bill. And it opens up a question: if those schools were not listed as part of the millage, when the voters voted on the millage, they intended the money to go where the millage said it was going to go. So it opens up some lawsuits over there. But I want to be very clear. Public schools in Michigan include charter schools. And the way that these public school academies get around this private issue, so there are no publicly chartered private schools in Michigan. The way they get around it is they have publicly chartered schools through a chartering organization, but then they hire a for-profit private company to run and manage those schools. So this money would indirectly go to for-profit organizations through this crazy, what The Atlantic calls the Wild West of public education in the state of Michigan.
Ken, what's your opinion on this proposal to use these local tax dollars for charters?
I think it's important to point out, and Vicki already mentioned this, that charter schools are public schools. They're not private schools. And the Republican view is if they're public schools, which they are, and public schools are allowed to get these enhancement millages with some restrictions locally, then charter schools, ergo, should benefit from that, just like more traditional public schools. Now, it's a little bit more complicated than that in the sense that these enhancement millages were part of Proposal A, which was a school finance reform, and it's our current system, but it was put in place 24 years ago. I think the real fundamental problem isn't this per se, it's that the current school finance system in Michigan, frankly, is an old design facing a new environment. These enhancement millages, these local millages you're talking about, they were designed before charter schools even showed up in Michigan and before they were authorized. So it's really kind of an old design trying to fit a new model, and it's not going to work.
In that case, let me ask both of you, what should we be doing? I mean, we've had a lot of problems since Proposal A back in what year was that?
1994.
So we've had a lot of problems since then, and they seem to be escalating in my mind. What should we be doing, Vicki?
Well, we should have been living up to the promise of Proposal A, and that was school districts that were considered at that time out of formula school districts, which meant they were bringing in more money and didn't have to be held to a particular formula that the state provided. Those out-of-formula school districts, and there were about 25 of them at the time, including many in Oakland County and some in Kent County, at the time that it was passed, they were promised that their per pupil share would go up no less than the rate of inflation. Well, that has not happened, and so those schools were not held harmless under Proposal A. In addition, Proposal A, when it talked about these enhancement millages, never talked about having them be passed intermediate school district-wide. They could have been levied by each individual school district. But the legislature decided in their infinite wisdom at the time that they would have to be grouped together by intermediate school districts in order to have these enhancement millages. So we've got a real funding issue and crisis, and the fact is the school aid fund has not grown at the rate of inflation or greater. And with the authorization of all these charter schools, each charter school is its own school district. In addition, the State Board of Education has no oversight over the charter schools. The authorizers, which, by the way, are usually universities, and they get 3% of the per pupil funding, those authorizers have the say, and there are no requirements for those authorizers to perform in order to receive that 3%. So it's a mess.
Ken, your opinions on how we should fix schools in Michigan?
Well, that's a big question, Lester.
You've got 2 minutes. Go.
I think the sort of battle you're talking about as to who gets these enhancement millages and who doesn't is, as I've indicated, indicative of the fact that I think Proposal A is just an old design facing a new environment. You have this particular issue that it's facing a greater variety of public school offerings than when it was designed 24 years ago. It was designed when two-thirds of our districts were growing in terms of enrollment. Now two-thirds of the districts are declining. And I think this funding model just hasn't kept pace with the needs. So I think this battle in the Senate this week is just more indicative that Proposal A is just an antiquated design. Now, it's going to be difficult to change it because it was adopted by the voters at the ballot box, and the legislature can only change the Constitution with a three-quarters vote. So I think it's going to be a challenge. School finance faces an environment that it didn't face 24 years ago.
We're talking right now about money. We should be talking about education outcomes and making sure that every child in Michigan has the opportunity to learn, become literate, live the American dream, and have a well-paying job at the end of their either high school, associate's, or college degree. And we have to stop talking about necessarily the money and start talking about the outcomes. And the proliferation of charter schools has not increased those outcomes. In fact, Michigan is falling further behind. So we have a lot of problems with school funding and outcomes for our children. The other side effect of this is people like me, I'm now an empty nester, and I could move, but my property taxes on my house now, because I've lived here for over 30 years, are really low. And for me to move as a senior on a fixed income, I really hate to say that, but, you know, we all get old. And for me to move would mean that my property taxes are going to ratchet up to the fair market value of the house I buy.
Yep.
So we have a whole bunch of seniors that are pretty much trapped in their large houses because they can't afford the uptick in the property taxes that are being subsidized by new people who move into their neighborhood.
That is Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislator. Thanks to both of you for filling us in on this.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings, and you've been thinking about fall again.
I have. It's my favorite season. So in particular, I've been thinking about heirloom apples. We have tons of different kinds of apples in the store, right? But there were hundreds and hundreds more than that have been grown over the years. And many of them taste delicious, but fell out of favor because they didn't travel well or they didn't look as pretty as consumers wanted, these perfect, round, shiny apples. But a lot of them taste way better than today's apples. So I've been on a little bit of an heirloom apple hunting excursion.
Where do you find heirloom apples?
Well, so I knew about some, I knew about Christmas Cove orchards up in northern Michigan, and I knew about Satsuma out near Grand Rapids, but I just found one near me. It's Albert Orchards and Cider Mill in Manchester. So I went on a little excursion and I picked up some apples, and I've had a couple of little apple tastings with my friends. And one of my favorites inspired me to make a cocktail.
So you've got this heirloom apple. I guess you have to figure out what it tastes like and what drink it might be good in.
Right. So the apple that we're using in this drink is called the Carmine de Sonneville, and it's developed in the Netherlands in about 1949. So it is the child of the Cox's Orange Pippin, and this is a classic apple from 1825 from England, and it is kind of like the standard bearer for all apples. This is the quintessential what apples should taste like. So it was crossed with the Jonathan back in 1949, and the result was this Carmine de Sonneville, which to me is kind of like what a Granny Smith wishes it could be. It's quite tart, but it's still juicy instead of dry and just has this really lovely apple flavor.
Okay, so what'd you do with it?
Well, I've had a cocktail that I've been making over the years, and it's called the La Manzana, and it is a tequila cocktail with apple. So I used our friends from tequila, Cabresto Tequila. I used their product in this, their silver tequila, an ounce and a half of that. First, I muddled about a sixth of that apple. The Carmine apples are really big. Normally, you'd want about a quarter of an apple. Because this one was so big, I used about a sixth.
Now, when you say muddle, I mean, so you don't just put it in there, a slice of it, start smashing. What do you do?
Right. So the first thing I did was I cut it up into pieces so I didn't have to work quite so hard. And then I just went at it with my muddler, really trying to get a lot of that juice out and to really pulp it up. So first that, then the ounce and a half of the Cabresto tequila. And because this is a tequila cocktail, we're using a couple other ingredients that go well with tequila. So I used some agave nectar, just a bar spoon of that to sweeten it. Some mole bitters from Bitterman's, which have some kind of spicy chocolate notes, which work well with tequila. And then shook that all up before topping it off with a Michigan hard apple cider. This is something that a friend just brought to my house last night. It's a bourbon barrel cider from Northville Winery. And it's quite tart and dry. It's almost more in the style of a European cider. And with that tart apple, I thought this would be a really nice pairing. There's no citrus in this drink, but when you taste it, you'll see that it's got a lot of tartness from the combination of the apple and the cider.
Okay, well, I guess that means that's my cue. That's funky.
Tastes to me a little bit like an apple margarita.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the apple, because of the cider and the apple, it's really present, but it's a different kind of apple taste than I've had before.
Absolutely, because that combination with the tequila isn't at all what you expect. And if you make this at home and you use a different apple and you use a different cider, you're going to get a totally different drink, which for me is a great part of the fun with it, right? You can play with whatever heirloom or not heirloom apples you manage to find this season and whatever dry, hard cider that you like.
That's brilliant. Thanks for making it.
Cheers.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. All right, stay with me for a moment. I'm going to throw a couple of numbers at you. They're pretty shocking. In 1920, there were 5.5 million white farm operators. By 2007, that number was down to 2.1 million. Fewer than half as many white farmers, but they own more acres, and they can farm that because of today's machinery. Now, let's look at this. In 1920, there were 926,000, approaching a million, black farm operators. By 2007, the number was just over 30,000. That's a small fraction, just 1/30th of the original number. That data came from a report titled Plight of Black Farmers in the Context of USDA Farm Loan Programs, a Research Agenda for the Future. Shakara Tyler is one of the co-authors of that paper published in Professional Agricultural Workers Journal. She's a PhD candidate at Michigan State University and works as an underserved farmer development specialist at MSU's Center for Regional Food Systems. So you noted in that report, in 1910, white farmers owned about 832 million acres of farmland. Now it's about 864 million, a little more. In 1910, black farmers owned about 16 million acres, and today that's down to 3.2 million. Why that disparity?
Well, there are many reasons why the disparity exists. For one, the racial discrimination by the United States Department of Agriculture, for short, the USDA. I mean, it's actually been proven through very systemic research that suggests or proves black farmers and many underserved farmers, farmers of color, and women farmers have all been discriminated against because of their race and gender. Black farmers, Latino farmers, indigenous farmers, and women farmers have all filed a lawsuit against the USDA in response to that discrimination.
But the USDA has this program called the Outreach and Assistance for Socially Disadvantaged Farmers and Ranchers and Veterans Farmers and Ranchers program. I mean, the goal is to help underserved farmers and to help them negotiate USDA programs and loans, help them succeed. So if they've got that going on, why are they failing in helping the very farmers they say they have this program set up for?
So the USDA created the socially disadvantaged applicants category in response to a lot of community pleas that the USDA wasn't paying attention to farmers of color and women farmers and those who are perhaps deemed on the underside of agriculture, so to say. And through a lot of advocacy by Black farming groups and other farming of color groups, they created a program to be accountable to these farming populations. The formal definition of an SDA applicant is anyone who has experienced prejudice, racial, ethnic, or gender prejudice by the United States Department of Agriculture. And since they typically have access to less financial resources and access to outreach because they don't have the social networks, they're not connected with the local agricultural county committees, they're not in the know of many programs. And so this program exists to serve them. Still, the USDA is set up in a way where there's a lot of decentralization. And so this program that exists
right,
at the federal level.
Almost every county has a USDA office.
Right. So the program that exists at the federal level is implemented in its own way at the local level, and the employees are not being held accountable to carry out the program in the way that it was intended to really help the farmers, because there aren't many accountability measures to ensure that.
So the USDA is one problem. I'm wondering, you know, in the past and currently in different ways, we've got all this kind of redlining and loans from banks and all the other different services. I suppose that's going to be a problem for people of color who are farmers, too. Loans from banks and some of the other issues they have to deal with. In what ways are African-American farmers and other minority or women farmers being underserved?
Oh, of course. Discrimination from private banks are an issue as well. And actually, the USDA farm loan programs were created to fill that gap. They were created to serve underserved farmers or small farmers in general. When the program was created, it was intended to, as I said, fill the gap because small farmers couldn't get loans from private banks. They called themselves the lender of last resort. And the farmer had to prove that they were denied a loan from a private bank in order to get the loan from the USDA. And then in Black farmers' cases and many farmer of color cases, those farmers were also denied USDA loans just because of their race or ethnicity.
Because it was only the local folks making the decision whether to hand up the application up the chain?
Right. Okay. And so there are a lot of stories that say farmers were told that there is no more money. You can't complete an application because the funds have run out. And then they'll say a white farmer came up behind them and they were able to complete an application. And they were able to get the money. And then there are stories from farmers that share they completed the application numerous times, and the farm loan officer always found something wrong with the application. And so they had to complete it again and again and again. And then 3 years later, when they get the money, what they needed the money for has changed. Their farm operation has died, and they didn't get the money in the sufficient amount of time needed. And so there are these really tragic stories where farmers of color have been denied their right to financial capital from the government.
Is this problem more or less prevalent in Michigan compared to other states?
Well, I would consider Michigan a fairly conservative state. From the stories that I've heard from Black farmers, mainly in rural areas, there are certain counties that are what we call, those are the racist counties, like Cassopolis, Michigan, and other counties. Like all of the stories, all of the farmers in that county have similar stories that one particular farm loan officer either ripped up their application, didn't give them an application, or whatever. They experienced discrimination within the realm of the same person. And I think it's a national trend, and it looks different by state, but Michigan is a microscopic view of what's happening on a national level.
Okay, so I want to
because you just called out somebody in Cassopolis. I just want to make sure that we cover this. What evidence do you have that that happened? I mean, is this part of the lawsuit that you mentioned earlier, or is this just anecdotal information that you've picked up talking to farmers in that area?
So it's both. So it's anecdotal information. I've done extensive research with Black farmers in that area. It's documented in another article that I wrote that was published in 2014. And that talks about Black farm owners' perceptions of financial capital acquisition within the USDA. And they talk about how there was a lack of outreach, there was a racial bias, and many other factors that inhibited them from attaining the financial capital necessary to build their farm operations. Many of these farmers in that county have applied for the Pickford class action lawsuit. They applied through Track A to get the $50,000 because they could prove that they were discriminated against.
I want to ask, what kind of resources are available to underserved farmers in Michigan? You've got your operation. What can you do to help them?
Since many underserved farmers tend to be cut off from a lot of the social networks in terms of completing paperwork, like a lot of technical assistance things, I sit down with them in their dining rooms, in their kitchens, or on their farms, and I help them with paperwork. We literally walk through page by page, and we get the paperwork done so they can submit it to the National Resource Conservation Service to get funding for a conservation program or USDA farm loan programs. I've actually took farmers to farm loan offices in local counties, so I could be an advocate for them. I think I sort of carry a little privilege when I say that I'm from Michigan State and I've done research on Black farmers. And, you know, we're all really aware of the discrimination historically and present. And so it's important that you carry out these services in a fair manner. I also connect them with foundations like philanthropies that can provide grant funding to their farms. So whatever they need help with, they call me, they say I need help with the paperwork, I need help with getting a grant, I need help with getting a loan, I'm there to assist however.
You know, I watch probably too much. I watch Anthony Bourdain TV episodes, and he makes the point again and again that you cannot understand the food you eat and the culture you live in until you understand the people who grow the food and prepare the food. American food history, especially America's southern food history, has been heavily influenced by Black Americans. Why would the government or society in general not fully recognize and assist African American farmers, or for that matter, Latino farmers or women farmers?
Why would they not assist? Ooh, well, okay.
I mean, these people are part of our culture. We wouldn't have a lot of the food we eat if it weren't for the different minority populations and women.
Right. And I'm happy you said that because we know that the current agricultural system in this country was built with the land and labor of people of color, pretty much. And it's because of people of color and especially women from all walks of life that have built this food system to what it is. And it's why we have what we have. And this is really difficult for me to answer that. I don't, it's a very political question. And so I'm trying to
Yeah, it's not the first
answer.
Time I've asked this kind of question to someone. I just want to hear, I mean, you know, what's your gut tell you?
Yeah, so it's no secret that land is power. And when you use land to build an economically sufficient community that's threatening to American agriculture that's rooted in capitalism. And so when farmers of color have access to these resources to basically be independent and to be self-sufficient with their farm operations and to provide for their community, it threatens the system that thrives on those farmers depending on that system. And so they don't want the farmers to be successful with their farming businesses because that would go against the ideals of dependency and paternalism within the overall American agricultural system, where white farmers are deemed the know-it-alls, the have-it-alls, and people of color are deemed the laborers, and they do all the grunt work, et cetera, et cetera.
Your title, Underserved Farmer Development Specialist, it's kind of a nice college title, but really, I mean, you're researching food justice, it seems to me. How well does that resonate with the majority of people who are pretty removed from agriculture these days? I mean, you know, everybody's a generation or two off the farm. They're just not that familiar with where our food comes from and how they get it. So does the work you're doing resonate with the people you know?
outside of the farmers?
Of course, of course. So actually, the U.S. Civil Rights Commission predicted that black farmers would be extinct by 2000 due to racial discrimination, but also other factors. Racial discrimination isn't the only factor for black land loss and land loss across many cultures. There's the low representation on county ag committees, the dominating growth of agribusiness, and affects all farmers, many small farmers to be specific. So due to specifically the racist policies previously mentioned, black people in particular have confused what happened on the land with the land itself. And so now we have this stigma around farming in black communities. While it's an established attitude within some circles, now farming represents something opposite of upward mobility. You know, it's backwards. It represents poverty. It's not a desired occupation.
That's interesting as we've become more of a foodie culture. I mean, people, there are some people, a fairly significant slice of people who are really wanting to know, who grows my food? Where can I get it? They're going to farmers markets. So again, talk to the person who actually grew their food. I find that surprising that so many people are saying that's stepping backward when farmers, especially farmers who grow the food we actually eat, not just corn and soybean, but, you know, the stuff we actually take to our table, are becoming of higher esteem.
Yes. So there is this return to the land movement, in a way, the farm to school, farm to table movement that's really popular and niche-y within many communities. And that's actually, that represents a small thread for why many black people are returning to the land, because we want to know where our food comes from. But we also want to be connected to our agrarian culture, because our agrarian culture started not here in enslavement back in the 16th century. It started way back in Africa. You know, we are agrarian peoples by nature. That's why we were stolen from our communities in Africa and brought here, because we were experts in agriculture. And so many people are becoming more aware of that and becoming more aware of the need to use the land as a source of resistance against the various oppressions that are imposed upon us as a black community.
Let's sum this up. What does government and society, for that matter, need to change to make sure minority and women farmers are not underserved?
I'm going to give several policy examples to illuminate this question. So the government has made some strides to help underserved farmers. They created the Office of Civil Rights at the federal level, and they also have created the 2501 program, which originated with the 1990 Farm Bill. And it was called the Minority Farmers' Right Act. Section 2501 of the Farm Bill was historically targeted to support funding for farmers of color or all underserved farmers generally, because that said that they have access to less resources. And so this money was intentionally set aside for these farming groups to use without white farmers dipping into it, or other farmers who have other privilege to dip into it. And so Within the SDA program, within the SDA category, it's women farmers, it's farmers of color, and now veteran farmers have been added to the category, which is a good thing because veteran farmers are also underserved. However, the 2501 program hasn't been fully funded as it was authorized back in 1990.
So adding the veterans just dilutes the amount of money.
Right, right. And so it stretches the amount of money, and then there's less money to go to those who really need it. And it's interesting because women farmers are the highest land-owning population in the country, and women farmers are considered, quote-unquote, socially disadvantaged. But many white women farmers in particular have access to funds that are not included in the 2501 program or not included in this underserved category. And so many white women farmers are getting funding from these commodity crop programs and these other programs, and they're also dipping into the underserved funding or the funding for underserved farmers. And so you can imagine that many farmers of color have little resources, even at the government level, because there's not enough money to go around for all the underserved farmers. And so if the government actually appropriated the authorized $10 million to the 2501 program, there would be more equity.
How much has it been shorted?
$6 million is the maximum that it's been appropriated.
Right, and we have a farm bill every 5 years, so
right.
It's stuck at that level for that entire 5 years
right.
unless there's a supplemental.
Yes, so the government would do best by underserved farming groups by authorizing more money to help them.
Shakira Tyler is a PhD candidate at Michigan State University and works as an underserved farmer development specialist at MSU's Center for Regional Food Systems. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Still to come, May Erlewine talks about songs on her latest album, Mother Lion. You can hear that in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. I think a lot of men were astonished when many of the women in our lives posted hashtag MeToo on Facebook and Twitter. I think women were already very aware. Friends, family, strong women we admired told us about sexual harassment and sexual assault that sometimes started when they were young. I mean, like adolescents. My next guest says the answer to hashtag MeToo is education. Wendy Sellers offers guidance through a thing called Puberty the Wonder Years. Her curriculum in that educates students about their bodies, puberty, sexuality, respect, healthy relationships, and communication. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Lester.
How can what you teach help keep men and boys from harassing and assaulting girls and women?
That's a great question. This is a huge issue, and it's endemic to our society, as hashtag MeToo has pointed out. And so we need to start young because these types of behaviors begin at a young age and continue into adulthood. And so one of the answers to these issues is educating young people about what healthy relationships look like and how to develop the skills to have healthy relationships, as well as what to do to intervene if a person is the object of sexual harassment or sexual assault.
In a response to hashtag MeToo, you wrote, when we have repeated talks about puberty and sexuality and answer the many questions children have about these topics, we remove the silence and stigmas that surround puberty and sexuality. Tell me how that works.
Well, in our culture, we have this expectation that we will not talk about sexuality, we don't talk about puberty. Many young people begin to experience changes that are normal and natural as they experience puberty, and they're caught off guard by that. That creates a lot of curiosity and mocking at times. And so by having open conversations, repeated conversations, and conversations that occur between a trusted adult and children, that can remove that stigma so that if people do have a problem with being sexually harassed or assaulted, they've already developed the skills and relationships to be able to talk to someone about those things.
So it makes it more normalized, not so taboo that they'd be embarrassed to talk to somebody about being touched inappropriately or something like that.
Yes, exactly.
You also wrote, children who are early bloomers are more likely to be targets of unwanted sexual attention than those who develop later. What should they know to help protect themselves?
Well, first of all, I think that parents and other trusted adults should talk to young people before they start to develop the signs of puberty so that they know what is coming and what to expect. And then we need to have open, honest conversations with both our young males and young females about what changes occur and how to behave in respectful manners if someone else is starting puberty earlier than they are. And that if they're curious, it's much better to go to a trusted adult to ask questions than it is to try to touch, harass, or sneak peeks at someone, which is very disrespectful behavior.
One of the points you made was every 98 seconds an American is sexually assaulted. Every 8 minutes that victim is a child, that's horrifying. Why hasn't this problem gotten more recognition and response?
Well, I believe that this is so embedded in our culture that we take it for granted. As you said early in the program, while this was shocking to most men that so many women were coming out with hashtag MeToo, it's not shocking to most women. And it's something that women have not been encouraged to come forward about. If you look at the rates of prosecution for sexual harassment and sexual assault, the rates of prosecution and conviction are very low because many times women have been punished for coming forward. They've been publicly humiliated and their reputations have been besmirched because of victim blaming and people not believing them.
I think a lot of parents are hesitant to talk about sexuality in any kind of explicit way with their children. They're afraid they're going to hit them with too much information too early in life. What would you recommend to them?
What I recommend is that all adults become very familiar with how to talk about these topics with children in a very age and developmentally appropriate manner. There are many wonderful resources on the internet and also on my website that help people understand how to have these conversations in an age-appropriate manner. The other thing is, it's important to remember that if you have a conversation with a child that they're not ready to hear, typically it will go right over their heads and they will come back to it at a later time when it's more relevant. So the fear that we have that we'll introduce these topics too early is really unfounded. It's just important to do it in a very sex-positive way, not in a fear-based or shame-based way.
Your curriculum is aimed at young people, and I keep wondering about what about the generations of adults whose awareness never came about? They weren't taught any of these things. I mean, many of these hashtag MeToo posts made it clear that this is an issue that men need to recognize and to which they need to respond. So what should adult men know that they didn't learn early in life?
I think adult men who are sincere about understanding this issue need to talk to women about it and try to have conversations about what is respectful behavior, what is frightening disrespectful behavior, and how can they be supportive. I also think that men could invest some time in reading about these issues to try to understand them further and ask a trusted partner for feedback on their own behavior and then modify it if they get feedback that there's something that they could improve. And as you said, many adults did not get taught about puberty, about healthy sexual relationships, or even healthy friendship relationships. And so it's really important that we also teach young people about media literacy, because so much of what we see in the media promotes this, what some people call rape culture, or at least a very paternalistic male dominance over females kind of culture. And so it's important that we also teach young people to see through the messages they see and hear all around them in the media and learn the skills they need to behave in a healthier way with their friends and their future partners.
So is there anything else that we really should realize as we're dealing with the youth today and what they should be aware of?
Yes, absolutely. A very important concept is that of consent. We need to teach both males and females about consent, which is two people voluntarily agreeing to do something or not to do something. It's important for both our boys and girls to learn that they should ask before touching someone or someone's possessions, and that the person that is asked has the right to say yes or no, and the importance of listening to that answer and honoring that answer. That can be taught at very young ages by teaching children that they have the right to say yes or no in sharing toys, and that they have the right to say yes or no in giving grandma or auntie a hug or a kiss.
Wendy Sellers offers guidance through Puberty, the Wonder Years. That's at pubertycurriculum.com. She's also co-author of the Michigan Model for Health. She wrote a response to the hashtag MeToo campaign. We'll post a link to that on michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham.
I was talking to the moon. I think it's time to make a change. It's happening soon. Time to pull up the roots and rearrange.
That's the voice of Mae Erlewine singing from her latest album. The title is Mother Lion. The Big Rapids native has been making music in the Traverse City area for more than 15 years, and she's an integral part of the Earthwork Music Collective. Now, Earl Wine is out with her 10th solo album, and she's introducing it first to Michigan audiences. She spoke with stateside producer Mercedes Mejia.
Yeah, I really thought a lot about how to release it, and I've been so lifted up and supported by the community here. So it seemed really fun and sort of tangible to be able to actually physically give the record and present the songs. I also haven't played most of them live ever. So it's sort of really presenting all of it as a whole piece for the first time. And then in November it'll be released, and we're doing a tour out east and then starting to get it out into the world a little bit broader. So
this was the first time that you worked with a producer in studio. And I'm wondering, can you describe what that process was like for you?
Well, it's hard to offer up that much sharing of the creative roles. So I never did, because I have a pretty strong vision a lot of time for my songs and feel attached to it in a certain way. And I worked with Tyler Duncan, who's local to Ann Arbor, and he produced the record and is also touring with me to release it. So the song that sort of sparked this collaboration was the song Wild. That's the opening track from the record. And I played it at a festival, at the Water Festival, and Tyler was there and he heard it and he came up and said something about it afterwards. And I just looked at him and I felt like he really understood it on a different level of where I was coming from with the song. And in that moment, I've been kind of wanting to work with him for many years. I've known him for a long time and have always had it in the back of my mind as something I'd like to do. And in that moment, I thought, now might be the time to do this.
If they ask about me, tell them I'm just taking my time. Tell them not to go looking, cause they won't like what they find. And if they wonder what it is that keeps the spark in that shine, they're gonna wonder a long time. I want the dawn to break me open. Wanna breathe and be unbroken. I want it to take a while. I wanna be wild. I wanna be wild.
It's been a long process of sort of having that conversation and then visioning the record and then actualizing it. And it's been very intentional and really a magical collaboration. He's a very special producer, friend, musician. He's very supportive of fostering a creative, vulnerable space and really encouraging you to go for it in ways that are not the norm. So he's kind of been this protector of vulnerable art and sharing difficult things and emotions that might not have space otherwise. So he's been a great steward of these really tender songs.
Long after I'm gone, I wanna feel years I've traveled. I wanna let myself unravel. Every minute, every mile, I wanna be wild. I wanna be wild.
On your website, I read this album was born of deep change and gratitude, grief and courage. And I'm wondering how you deliver these songs, how important the lyrics are, and how you want to communicate them to your audience.
To me, the words are probably the most important. And the vocals on this record are very intimate and almost like a speaking way. So it's definitely delivering, like it's like a conversation, a very personal conversation is what the record feels like to me. So the words are very, very crucial in that. And then it was actually really looking at the global grief that we're experiencing right now and just all the tragedy that's happening and how much pain we're carrying in a society that's very fast-paced. And there's not a lot of sort of support for the grief of like maybe the political climate or the grief of the environmental climate or just the things we carry in our hearts in our own personal lives. So there's not a lot of good structures on how to deal with that, especially when it's more of the global grief. So these songs are sort of, they're very personal, but then they're also really hitting on that sentiment of it's okay to feel these difficult things and trying to make a little room for it.
Well, let's take a listen to the single, Never One Thing.
I'm the underbelly, I am the
claw, never one thing, no, not one thing at all. I'm a street fighter, I'm a prayer for peace. I'm a holy roller, I'm a honeybee. I am the truth, I am a lie. I am the ground, I am the sky. I am the silence, I am the call. Never one thing, no, not one thing at all. I'm the underbelly, I am the claw. Never one thing, no, not one thing at all. I'm a street fighter, I'm a prayer for peace. I'm a holy roller, I'm a honeybee.
The song came from the Whitman quote. It's like, I am large and contain multitudes. It was written for an all-female group originally, and that group never ended up performing live, so the song has been sitting around, and then when I began to work with Tyler, I showed him this song, and he was excited about it, and he asked me to just write as many verses as I could. And so I really, like, dove into the idea of that we're kind of asked to be, and fit in these, like, labels and boxes, and even as artists, we do that. But especially as women, it's like a hard road to break out of the confines of what we've been told to be. So this song is really like kind of blasting out of the stigmas. And it was definitely for me as a woman in the world, and now being a mother to a little girl, very important to try to break some of those confines open.
Well, let's take a listen to one more song off your new album before we let you go. This one is called Hurricane.
Here we are, just waiting on the sky, all teary with the heartache in our eyes. I will love you until the day I die. That much is true. And we've ironed out the wrinkles, I suppose.
This song is probably the most kind of fiery on the record. And it's a song about not being able to escape from our past and letting that be slightly scary, but also a comfort that we can lean into our past and our experiences supporting where we are. And so it's a powerful thing to look back sometimes, and that's sort of what the song is about. It's one of my favorite ones to play. There's like a really cool, like, kind of distorted guitar riff, and it just has a lot of energy to it that's fun. And the harmonies are really exciting too, so that one's been fun to play.
May Erlewine has a few album release shows coming up, including one tonight at the 10 Pound Fiddle in East Lansing, and then on Saturday at the Arc in Ann Arbor. You can find details on our website, michiganradio.org. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Say what's done is done. If you wanted to. And I made it through the wait a thousand times. Here I stand, still coming out alive. How long can you live on a lie?
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock, who likes those apples from Albert Orchard. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Have a great weekend.